Hello and welcome to Monocle 24's The Urbanist, the show all about the cities we live in. I'm Andrew Tuck. Coming up on this week's programme.
Replace that highway, very 1950s mentality with a boulevard, an urban boulevard, and lo and behold, there is perhaps some slowing in the absolute sense, but it turns out to be a net positive in terms of urban livability.
Tailbacks, roundabouts, pedestrian crossings, and traffic lights. These are all elements of city living, as cars still dominate much of our urban space. But is it all about to change? Join us over the next 30 minutes as we look at how traffic and driving impacts us, hear Madrid's radical approach to curbing down on car emissions, and even ask one lucky Monocle contributor to become a traffic light for a day. That's all coming up right here on The Urbanist with me, Andrew Tuck. So welcome to this week's programme. You don't necessarily need to drive to be impacted by traffic every day. From pollution to congestion and noise, traffic is a complex being. And this week, we've tried to unpack it. Almost 10 years ago, Tom Vanderbilt wrote a book called Traffic: Why We Drive the Way We Do, and many of its findings still ring true today, especially on what our driving says about us. He joined me earlier from New York to talk about this and much more. Tom, almost a footnote to begin with. You wrote this book, it came out in 2008. Since then, we've had so much kind of hyperbole and kind of talk about how traffic is going to change with driverless vehicles and new technology. Do you buy into that, or do you think we're stuck with traffic as a problem, inverted commas, for years to come?
It's a very good question. And given that, you know, you can read people talking about trying to deal with traffic congestion going back to essentially ancient Rome. I mean, anytime you try to assemble people in cities, which are the most productive places for human endeavor, and I mean, it goes back a century in Los Angeles. They were trying, for example, to figure out, well, maybe if people just altered their work hours and we could get off of the morning rush hour and afternoon rush hour. Well, you know, it turns out there's a reason why people like to work in the same place at the same time, which is kind of the essential problem when you're talking about traffic. So back to your original question, though, you know, driverless cars, Uber, I mean, a lot of these things show this promise in the beginning. And in New York City, at least, we've just had a report come out showing that Uber, it's great, it's convenient, it's perfect for everyone's individual trips. The problem is used en masse. We're already seeing an uptick in congestion in New York City, which almost seems people would think that's not possible, but it is actually getting worse because it's taking some people off the subway, which itself is in a horrible state. The sheer convenience of it has made it almost irresistible to people. So there's sort of these unintended consequences that do come up that always have to be really paid attention to.
Your work around traffic has had a following, a resonance, excited people, because it didn't just look at the mechanics of how we get in our vehicles and why we get a little bit kind of caught up on a day-to-day basis, but more you pulled examples from nature, you pulled examples from psychology. As you began to unpack, for example, why we do get caught up in traffic jams, and I know you talk about the accordion effect and all manner of things, what did you begin to understand about us as drivers and how we drive our vehicles that caused this problem?
One of the problems is, again, there's sort of a tension in traffic between what people have sort of referred to as user optimality and system optimality. So everyone does what they think is the best thing for themselves, which is, number one, get into a car. But, you know, as you start to add those things together, it does not become great for the system. And to take a very concrete example, you can see on an individual level how we as drivers can actually contribute to this congestion just in the way we drive, not just the fact that we're in a vehicle to begin with. But there's a fascinating video online. Some Japanese physicists took a closed circular track and they had a series of cars. They asked drivers to drive at a steady speed and following distance to the car in front of them. And it begins in this nice orchestrated, kind of strange looking circular parade of vehicles. But very quickly, one driver would sort of drive too closely to the person in front of them. Then they would brake and the person behind them didn't know exactly how much they were braking. So it introduced this instability, which quickly started to generate these sort of shockwaves. And you can see them unfolding in this nice little cohesive pattern. And this is exactly what happens on the highway, this sort of uncertainty. And people are always kind of looking for individual gain and changing lanes. And that sort of throws this perfect optimality off. And this, to my opinion, is one of the potential benefits of driverless cars, which you referred to before, which is that you can actually take some of that human temptation to do those sorts of things and the kind of instability and even out the system and make it more harmonious. This, of course, is dependent on the idea that the algorithm will be created in a way that is not trying to maximize that sort of behavior that we do as humans. And this tension has already been playing out on the streets in the United States. I was actually just at Waymo, which is Google's self-driving car, a few weeks ago, and there are tensions wherever these cars are deployed because they don't actually behave the way human drivers do. They're a little bit more cautious. They're not trying to constantly game the system at places like intersections. So this can actually create problems for the humans around them.
One of the interesting things, again, touching on that is, you know, you talk there about the commute, and I guess, you know, a driverless vehicle, it wouldn't have road rage probably. The interesting thing is it's also on these kinds of trips we're imagining these vehicles would be best suited for, the mundane kind of journey where most accidents happen. In your book, you also point out to this strange anomaly, actually the most dangerous roads in the sense of hairpin bends, changing scenery, dramatic twists and turns, we tend to focus. And in these situations, we lose our focus. Are we not really designed as humans to be suburban drivers?
Well, driving is a curious thing if you really think about it. On the one hand, it's very complex. We're doing an amazing amount of activities all at once and processing huge amounts of information. But it, you know, of course, it becomes automatized over time in our own brains. And at the same time, it's very complex. It's very simple. It becomes very routine. So we're often called in these sort of extreme situations to take the wheel or, you know, to react to something. So it is this long periods of boredom, occasionally separated by moments of much more excitement. But to talk about driving, distracted driving, some people think that today's people, you know, sort of growing up with digital technology so prevalent in their life, that driving is the distraction. So when you get in an automobile, you know, people would rather be doing other things. And as you say, on a highway, creeping along in slow congestion, this is not a very fun thing to do. So why not hand it over to the machine?
Thank you to my passenger, Tom, there. Now, we're going to leave it there for just a moment because the last fortnight has seen the Spanish capital suddenly emerge as a new European leader in the fight to curb car fumes. A scheme to restrict non-residential traffic is showing why success often depends on a skillful balance between both carrot and stick. And our Madrid correspondent, Liam Aldous, took to the pavements to breathe in the new milieu and track down those pioneering change.
On the 30th of November 2018, madrileños are woke to a rather apocalyptic forecast.
Los comerciantes, los dueños de parkings y otros colectivos que dicen esto les va a arruinar la protesta.
Chaos in the streets, the calamitous collapse of social order, a death blow to business. After years of diffidence, Madrid Central, a long gestating plan to implement permanent sweeping restrictions on intercity traffic, had finally arrived, and the usual gaggle of hysterics were going into hyperdrive. One prominent firebrand, conservative mayor of outlying town Alcorcón, went so far as to tweet pictures of the Berlin Wall, claiming communists love erecting walls and restricting people's free movement. That commie jab pointed squarely at Madrid's progressive left-leaning mayor, Manuela Carmena.
Un proceso de una lucha clara, pues, por tener una ciudad mejor. Y lo importante es eso.
By day's end, with the benefit of actual numbers, road congestion across Madrid Central's 472 hectares had fallen by 45%. When fully enforced, estimates say these new rules will curb vehicle emissions by 40%. Madrid has long lagged behind its European peers in environmental action, especially in tackling its nefarious smog. So how did the city suddenly pole vault into the role of pioneer? Key to it all were madrileños themselves. Just listen to a reporter's efforts on the regional broadcaster's breakfast show, jamming his mic through car windows, fishing for dissent on the newly renovated and now traffic-restricted boulevard Gran Vía.
Una pregunta, señor motorista. ¿Se nota que está en funcionamiento Madrid Central?
See if you can gauge the mood of motorists, keeping in mind a favor is positive, while en contra means opposed.
A favor o en contra de Madrid Central?
A favor.
¿Están ustedes a favor o en contra de Madrid Central?
Hombre, pues a favor, ¿no? Está bien. Pues a favor de que haya menos contaminación.
¿Está a favor o en contra de Madrid Central?
Estoy súper a favor.
¿Y usted, señora, que tiene niños?
Súper a favor.
Predicar como que se va...
While the opposition forecasts imminent chaos or the apocalypse, eventually time and reality will put everyone in their place. Opposition is fine, but with such a lack of rigor and with so much opportunism, they just open themselves up to ridicule.
Y con tanto oportunismo que te lleva al ridículo.
Inés Sabanés is Madrid's motivated environment and mobility councillor, and we're sitting in her wide-windowed sixth-floor office at City Hall.
Well, one thing I've noticed just sitting here in your office is that we can actually see on the horizon the little line of Madrid pollution. Is that something that encourages you every day?
Yes, I see it continuously. But keep in mind, Madrid, especially this time of year, always has a high risk of pollution, which has been a problem for many years, meaning it needs to be tackled forcefully.
De forma continua.
Sabanés has spent the last 3.5 years overseeing the ambitious environmental Plan A, cue the slogan, because there's no Plan B, which encompasses 30 different measures, from the renaturalization of the Manzanares River to more pedestrian-friendly pavements.
We had to make a great effort, a measurable effort. There may be the occasional breach of pollution protocols, but you need a clear roadmap. Namely, what has to be done tomorrow, what has to be done in 2020 and in 2030. I think what Madrid did well was simple. Cooperate with other cities, take international inspiration and listen to experts and professionals.
So what you're saying is that first you listen to what the people wanted, second you listen to experts, and third you planned long term, which is a recipe which isn't very common in politics these days.
No, pero es la única.
No, but it's the only way. The immediacy of the easy headline might deliver short-term results, but it's a grave mistake to let this approach guide a city's politics. And I'm a strong believer in politics. What happened in Madrid is a familiar story in many other cities. Cities possess a strong position of leadership when it comes to change, sometimes much more powerful than nation-states, because we have more tools at our disposal. But the main thing we need to have a clear head about, whether we like it or not, is that these challenges aren't constrained by electoral timetables.
Another key to Madrid Central's rollout has been a softly, softly approach. Motorists won't start receiving fines until several months from now, with the interim period focusing on informing rather than reprimand.
I believe it's essential to do so gradually. This fuels debate, which helps people understand the objective and where their obligation lays.
Eschewing the standard electoral myopia and championing greater cooperation between cities to share learnings, Sabanés also says that cities and city planners need to ask themselves one question.
¿Qué hago yo para preservar?
What am I doing to fulfill my pledge? If my only focus is winning elections, we would never take the step, because there's never a convenient moment. That's what always happened in Madrid, between preparing policy or not preparing it, the elections crept up and nothing was done. You just have to push ahead. The people will decide.
Y la gente dirá.
Back amongst the foot traffic, I stopped by the studio of street art collective Boa Mistura, who are part of a fully-fledged charm offensive aimed at pedestrians.
There are 1,100 verses in the street, and we have received poems from the people and from poets.
After a bout of guerrilla art, saw them emblazon 33 poetry verses on Madrid streets back in 2014, Madrid's mayor invited Boa Mistura to expand the project as a way to encourage pedestrians to see walking as a poetic act.
How many submissions did you get?
More than 20,000. More than 20,000, yeah. We have to read all of them, select it, and then classify them.
Explain to me the idea that the city wants to make walking a poetic act. Is that just a bit of marketing, or do you think there's something to it to kind of encourage people to walk?
For us, as we did this project 4 years ago, for us it's just an artistic activity. It's an artistic intention when we do this. Of course, if we write a poem in the street, we are telling, okay, you can use the street for something else than walking and going from one point to another point.
The streets and the cities are lots of emotions because there are people that are, for example, are in love, and you got to write something for the people who are in love, but there are people who are angry or people who are excited or thinking about other things or sad, even sad. And poetry talks about emotions, not only love.
I think this project is one of the tentacles to make the city more friendly to the people, because we have to start to think the street like something else that a place to move and to drive is a place where everything can happen. So why not poetry?
Underwriting this overnight success story is Madrileños' underestimated civic pride. Proving they favour less cars and cleaner air, the national Spanish government is now proposing to ban high-emission vehicles in 138 Spanish urban areas by 2025. After all the theatrical huff and puff, down here on the ground, the simple promise of clean air is being inhaled with a collective breath of enthusiasm. For Monocle in Madrid, I'm Liam Aldous.
Now, what's interesting about the design of our roads and how we put in traffic management systems is that they reflect the times, this moment that we're living in. In the 1950s and 60s, for example, there was this feeling that if we built big open highways and allowed for speed to happen, the cars would move very fast. But we've ended up with cities like London, where one-way roads are being turned into two-ways, or we've implemented flat road surfaces with pavements so that all drivers have to slow down. Essentially, we're trying to make jams. We're trying to make problems so that pedestrians can be safer. I asked Tom Vanderbilt if he thought that this was a fair assessment.
I think it is, and I'm not sure that a traffic transportation engineer would say or admit to the idea that they're slowing things down, but in some ways they're coming to the realization that, you know, in cities we're responding to the suburban out-migration and trying to think, well, if we just make it convenient for people to come in and out of the city, that's the best thing. Well, it turned out that was just sort of a one-way. We were helping this one-way exodus and not making it particularly pleasant for people that were still there. And so we have, you know, all these overbuilt highways, which, you know, there's a lot of interesting cases of things that have been taken down often by accident. Something like the Embarcadero Freeway in San Francisco, which was a big highway running right through town, collapsed because of the earthquake. And there are strange moments like this where that opens this moment of experimentation, which otherwise would not have been possible, to then replace that highway, very 1950s mentality, with a boulevard, an urban boulevard. And lo and behold, there is perhaps some slowing in the absolute sense, but it turns out to be a net positive in terms of urban livability and just a much safer, more reflective place. But I think, you know, we've just spent so long trying to think we can build our way out of congestion, as it's almost a cliche, that statement, but realizing that, you know, we really need to start managing the demand. And if we're not going to win the battle against traffic, what can we do to make best for all users of an urban context, which is really, in a place like New York City, automobile drivers are the minority in that case. So why have we devoted so much of our space to cars? I mean, go to any intersection in Manhattan and count pedestrians, cyclists in that intersection versus cars. And it's overwhelmingly, you know, pedestrians and cyclists, yet the real estate given over to cars can be on the order of 10 times higher than what everyone else has been given.
Just coming to the actual book, of all the topics you could have written about, what was it about the science of traffic, the psychology of traffic that lured you in the first place?
I think it was just having grown up in the Midwest of the United States, where, of course, at age 15, I got my learner's permit and quickly got my license. And I was just, it was so in my DNA to be a driver. But then moving to New York, and I still did some driving, but I think it became a stranger thing to me. You know, when you're so wrapped up in something as an everyday pursuit, it becomes hard to step back and look at it. And it started to occur to me that I was doing it less frequently. So when I did do it, I paid more attention. And I thought, you know, there's a lot of strange sort of dynamics going on here. You know, why does this sort of thing happen? And just in terms of a book, once I started bringing up some ideas to people, I just found that, you know, there are a few topics which you can instantly, you know, relate to anyone or start a conversation about. And traffic is one of them, you know, sort of like weather or something. And often it's small talk, but people do get incredibly passionate about various topics. So that just seemed like, you know, there's something that hadn't really been explored here. And there's just an immense underground literature, I'll call it, from the transportation engineering community. I mean, people would be, you know, sort of surprised to realize that something like a, let's just say they're converting a four-way intersection from, I don't know, stop signs to a roundabout. I mean, the amount of thought and engineering that has to go into that is just, I mean, books are written about that particular conversion. Trying to bring some of that sort of secret history that's right in front of our eyes to light was kind of what motivated me.
And then finally, in this world of game plan and the strategy you need as a driver, whether urban or not, did you come to a personal conclusion, and has it stuck with you as a driver when you get in a car these days? Do you think it's better to be a little bit more aggressive, to be the person who cuts in the line, or have you gone back to being the person who merges way before the junction?
I try to take what might be called a Zen approach, because I realized in a place like New York City, a complex urban environment, there may be momentary gains that are achieved, but in the long run, those savings just do not compute to any meaningful thing. I mean, it can be actually more meaningful to change my entire mode. And this is something that interests me about urban living nowadays, is that I do actually have a car, but 9 times out of 10, it's actually the worst option of all the transportation I can. So it caused me to be very careful about if I'm going to do that. So when I actually do drive, then it's just driving can be an incredibly stressful activity, obviously. So trying to add time pressure to that, or having this gamified mentality or aggressive thing, just makes it that much worse, I think. And again, this would be, I think, the great promise of driverless cars, is taking away that human element, which I think a car typically does nothing to improve a person's personality. A person does not become a better person behind the wheel of a car. There are just a lot of factors that contribute to making that person negative. I mean, the lack of feedback, the anonymity, the idea that you're in a personal space in public space, it just does not promote pro-social behavior. So that's my hope for driverless cars, again, as long as the algorithms are friendly algorithms.
That was the author Tom Vanderbilt, and his book is called Traffic: Why We Drive the Way We Do. It's almost time to head off now, but before we do, congratulations are in order, because this week marks 150 years since the very first traffic light in the world was installed, and it happened right here in London, outside the Houses of Parliament, indeed. We asked our contributor, Andrew Muller, to take a stationary position on the curb and be that very traffic light for a day.
There are now so many of us that there can barely be a human being alive who hasn't sighed or sworn at one of us. But then you don't go into this business to be thanked. The knowledge of the thousands, millions of lives we have saved is satisfaction enough, however unwitting or ungrateful the beneficiaries of our vigilance. Though I'm not going to pretend I've never stifled a chuckle when some cyclist who thinks he knows better than I do ends up careening over his handlebars. We are traffic lights. We are pretty much everywhere, bar a few militantly resistant jurisdictions. Bhutan, I believe I'm right in saying, may be the last holdout, though it's tough for me to look these things up, as I'm a traffic light. But I was the first, or more correctly, I'm a descendant of the first, which was erected at the corner of Great George and Bridge Streets here in London in December 1868, more or less where I stand now, outside the Houses of Parliament in London. This means, you will notice, that the traffic light predates the car as a feature of this particular urban landscape, but there is no doubt that my ancestor was necessary. Even armed only with horses and carts and trams, Londoners were managing to kill 1,000 of their fellow citizens on the roads annually. Taking the pride in our work that we do, we've never been entirely sure what to make of the founder of our tribe. That first traffic signal was a handsome iron apparition, 6 metres tall, which governed the comings and goings outside Westminster with a sort of semaphore system. When the arms at the top were lowered and a green light shone, go. When they were raised with a red light, stop. It was powered by gas and operated by a police officer. It was certainly necessary. Not long before its installation, two members of parliament had been seriously injured and a policeman killed in accidents in the vicinity. And it received, initially at least, good reviews. Quoth the Illustrated Times, "The regular town drivers are fairly and to quite unexpected extent amenable to the signals. A noble tradition of service appeared to have been efficiently established." At which point, we must acknowledge, ashamedly, that our progenitor's legacy was a mixed one. After a promising few weeks of deterring carriages and stagecoaches from pranging into each other, a gas pipe powering that first traffic light exploded, seriously injuring the police officer operating it. For the next half century and change, British road users preferred to take their chances without us. But we were, if one may flirt with immodesty, an idea ahead of our time. It took electricity and Americans to turn us into the ubiquitous fixtures that we now are. In August 1914, a red-green electric traffic light was installed at the corner of East 105th Street and Euclid Avenue in Cleveland, and operated by a police officer in a booth. Automatic systems began appearing in American cities in the 1920s. The oldest one still operating is in Asheville, Ohio, an Art Deco science fiction apparition dating from 1932. Our reconquest of Britain began in Prince's Square in Wolverhampton in 1927. And here we still are, and here I still am, outside Parliament. 150 years of offering sage counsel regarding when to plough ahead, when to stop to prevent accidents, and when it might be prudent to slow up. More than once, it's occurred to me that a few of the people in the building behind me could use such a device in their offices. And if that's not an especially well-worked satirical conceit, what do you want from me? I'm a traffic light. Let's see Private Eye magazine try to keep this junction clear. Anyway, back to work. People are starting to honk.
That was a very still Andrew Mueller. And that's all we have for this week's episode of The Urbanist. The show was produced by Carlo Tarabello and it was edited by David Stevens. And to play you out of this episode of The Urbanist, here's Elton John with Heavy Traffic. Thank you for listening, City Lovers. Suicide. 'Cause we're